Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, joined as always by Nick Osello, who is fresh off of a trip south of the border. And we are at mid-season. Nick, how are you holding up?
I'm good. Been moving a little bit slow. You know, is what it is. And I'll just say this, you know, I think Mexico is a delightfully, awesome place. The top of my head is thoroughly sunburnt and my BAC is returning to normal levels. And my brain is just starting to fire on all cylinders once more. So watch out.
Can't wait to talk about college lacrosse with a fellow sunburned scalpist.
Love that. And by the way, fun fact, that's how I knew that I needed to just start bicking my head and shaving it full go, was I was hanging on for dear life there at the end, and I got a sunburn on the top of my head when I quote unquote had hair.
Okay. Can you recall the activity? Because I will say I have never been more sunburned than I was at the 2014 World Championships, which just so happened to be in Denver, Colorado. And I am convinced that being a mile closer to the sun has a material effect on how much UV you absorb.
It was snorkeling. It was snorkeling.
And oh, that'll get you. Water reflection, you get it from both directions.
Yep, water reflection, it magnifying through the water droplets. I was like, did I literally slide high and late with the crown of my helmet and just don't remember it?
Into the sun.
Into the sun, yeah. I went helmet to helmet and got ejected for targeting from the sun. So
we are here to talk about Charlotte Claire giving up that late lead to Max. Oh, no, we're not talking about Formula One. That's just a side gig of mine. We are talking about college lacrosse, and as mentioned, it is halfway through the season. Basically, every conference has started except for like the CAA and a couple of the other ones that have five teams or five opponents to play 16 leagues, so to speak. And yeah, things are heating up. But before we dive into this past weekend's action, we're going to reflect on some of the things that have happened over the first month and a half, 2 months, depending on how early in February these teams got started. And so, Nick, to get things going, I want to know, who is your team of the year so far?
This is a tough one because every team that I'm like, oh, this is who they need to be, I feel has dropped a bad game. I think Maryland's too typical of an answer, and I think
they're off the board.
Yeah, what's
made Maryland, you're number one. You don't need us to be your team, our team of the year. Like, that would just be piling on. You wouldn't even notice.
Yes, correct. So I have number one and number two teams of the year. My number one team of the year so far is Jacksonville, because they are, regardless of what they end up as, regardless of how they pan out and play out, I think they've been one of the most interesting talking points of the year. And it's one of the very first times everybody has always talked about the parity of lacrosse and how, oh, this, you know, the winners win, the losers lose. And there's always one team that might make a playoff run, but very few teams storm out of the gate, play as good as they did, have as young of a coach as they do, have the right geographic location. And they are one of the first teams that I would use to say, hey, you think that it's just the classic Maryland, Virginia Dukes of the world. Watch out for this team called Jacksonville. That's my number one. My number two would be Harvard, because I think they represent a very, it could be Penn, it could be Yale, the Ivy League's kind of beating the shit out of each other. Could be Princeton, really. Harvard is like, I didn't think they would be as good as they are. And they're the team where I was like, okay, depending on how they are, that's how good I think the Ivies are. And they were better than I had originally assumed, which speaks more to the point that I think one of the interesting points of this year is the shifting of the tides away from the ACC and distributing that power across the board. Jacksonville's my favorite story. Harvard, I think, is the most interesting story as the Ivies take the crown of most dangerous conference right now. Who's your team of the year?
So I love that, and I'm really glad that you had a two-pronged answer because I think Jacksonville is a really good answer. And I'm also glad that you took Harvard off the table because I'm going to take the Ivy League team that you didn't mention, which is Cornell. And so Cornell, I think to me, their eye-opening win was at home against Ohio State. Ohio State had beaten North Carolina. They had beaten Harvard. So, that was a stamp. Right, a we arrived type moment. In addition to that, obviously, I'm picking them at a low point. They're coming off of their first loss of the season. But a couple other reasons that they're my team of the year so far. You can't look past the fact that Connor Bucic is a first-year head coach. He is leading a staff that is the youngest staff in college lacrosse, as Mark Dixon and Dan Flynn very clearly established on their podcast on Friday. So I think that's an important consideration. But then in addition to that, and this isn't to say that there haven't been a ton of teams that have dealt with significant injuries, but the Big Red have dealt with some significant injuries. They lost Michael Long for a couple games. He's back now. John Lombardi has gotten hurt. He hasn't come back yet. And there are a couple other guys who I think they would have expected to contribute to this point that have been out of the lineup as well. So, they've weathered some storms in that respect, and they got off to a great start. So to this point, I'm going to say that the Big Red are my team of the year.
I like that answer. And
Thank you.
we broke the news a while back that Jeff Teat was going to Denver. They certainly weren't happy with us, but they forgave us. So, credit to them. Yes, they have a young coaching staff. Yes, they're off to a good year. But don't forget about the more important things in life, Terry. Forgiveness. It's more than saying sorry.
So I have a funny perspective on that.
Okay.
Because when you guys tweeted that, I wasn't like, oh yeah, they're way off base. This is completely wrong. I had spoken to an individual who was in a dorm room with Jeff Teat, who was himself going through the process of
Was it TD
transferring to,
Ireland?
and he said that Jeff is going to transfer to Denver.
Was it TD?
It may or may not have been that person.
Because that's TD, and he was the one that leaked us our information. So he's an enemy of the post game. So TD, you suck, and you're a loser, and you look like you're 12 years old, and I'm better at face-offs than you. I can't wait to hang out with you soon.
All right. So that's a perfect segue into who is your player of the year so far?
Now, everyone's going to accuse me of bias. I don't want to hear it. I really don't because this kid's playing unbelievable. Arden Cohen, we talked about him last week, and he just held Matt Moore to what, 0-1?
Yeah, he definitely didn't score. I don't know how many assists he had. I saw one assist that was like a beautiful X, or I'm sorry, a beautiful drive from X to kind of like GLE right-handed, and it was a like great cross-piece feed for an easy finish. But yeah, I mean, generally speaking, he didn't have the day Connor Schellenberger had.
No. So whether it's Maryland, whether it's Ohio State, whether it's Virginia, I feel like he's been the shining star of what is more often than not a better loaded Notre Dame defense. But when he's the anchor of it, I think he does a great job as far as I really think Notre Dame's going to slap Syracuse around because if Arden Cohen takes away Dordovic and they have that single, point one point of attack. I think he's a great one of the best in the country at stopping the other team's best player. And here's an honorable mention, Terry. Simp alert is what, I'm going to get accused of. Charlotte North is making women's lacrosse much more interesting to the point that I seek out her highlights after a Boston College victory or loss. More often than not, they just pop up on our Twitter feed. Legitimately, the most electric player I've seen in women's lacrosse history and is making it more entertaining, and is the first player that I've sought out since my sister was playing and I was just trying to be a good brother. So I will give her, kind of women's player of the year in a cakewalk. But I just wanted to call her out as being purely electric and Arden Cohen as who I think is the player of the year so far.
Okay, I'm gonna go with a player who I don't know. I don't want to say he had a good day against Arden Cohen, but I'm gonna go with Jack Myers as my player of the year. I think Patrick McEwen, who may or may not be making an appearance on this podcast, made a really good point on the Inside Lacrosse Slack on Sunday afternoon, which is that the Buckeyes go as Jack Myers goes. And he has, and we've talked about this on prior episodes of this podcast, really, I don't want to say added to, but accentuated the distribution element of his game to a repertoire that includes the ability to get to the dirt and score, as well as shoot from the mid-range. And I think the combination of all of those factors has really stood out to me. Ohio State is 6-3. They're kind of on the cusp of my team of the year from the standpoint of they weren't a top 20 team in the preseason. So I think that what they've done to this point exceeds pretty much everybody's expectations, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. But it's easier for me to say that when I look at those three losses, I'm going to give credit to Myers because, yeah, he was limited in those games, but I think it speaks to when he does play well, exactly how important he is for a team that I think is one of the more impressive in the early season and the early going so far.
Legitimate, but he beat Notre Dame, and I don't like him for that.
Yeah, no, it's an acceptable response. I mean, it's not, obviously, but I think we know you, so nobody's surprised to hear you say that.
Yeah, just walking into a brick wall and going from there. So I agree. And that's another, like, you know, I always feel like there's a couple guys out there that are completely electric. And if they have a good game, their team is having a good game. And to go off of your point earlier, Patrick sending in that thing into the Slack, I was like, that's really interesting because I would love to see more statistics on that. Like, who has the biggest impact per point scored on the team's win-loss per game? Like, there's got to be some way to look at that. And I would imagine that just based off of the screenshot that he sent would be, you know, he would be number one for sure.
Well, that actually,
like, some stat, like, what's the Jack Myers GPA of the day or something?
It gives me an opportunity to shout out my bias, which is Michael Bame, the lefty attackman, sophomore from Michigan, who he's got 50 points, whereas Josh Sawada has 59. And as had been previously discussed on multiple podcasts, including this one and the postgame, he has already set the program record for Michigan. So certainly Sawada has received a lot of the shine. But I look at Bame, who, in addition to his 50 points on 29 goals and 21 assists, has 22 ground balls and 8 caused turnovers, which, according to the Inside Lacrosse fantasy point scoring system, is 230 points accrued in 10 games so far this year. He's averaging 23 points per game. He's one of the safest bets from a fantasy gameplay standpoint. And if you take out his performances against Holy Cross and Canisius, in which I assume he didn't play a ton, then those two numbers are even more impressive and more substantial. He's coming off of a 2-2 day against Johns Hopkins, in which he had a ground ball and a cost turnover. And against Notre Dame, he had 3-1 with 3 ground balls and 2 cost turnovers. He rises to the level of the competition in a positive way. And Mike Bame, you know, I don't think the Wolverines are NCAA tournament bound, so I don't think he necessarily is, you know, substantially a part of a conversation like this, but certainly deserving on the basis of how impressed I am with what he has done. Moving along.
Very, I mean, what do I even say to that? Yeah, moving along.
Nick, what is, you're very online, and so I expect this to be up your alley, except for the fact that I'm afraid there's a very obvious response that happened in the last 48 hours that's going to be very hard to overlook. What is your play of the season so far?
I know exactly what you want to call out, and I'm not going to say it. I'm going to say it's the Jacksonville goalie scoring a goal against Air Force.
Don't hate it.
Yeah. I think 10-man rides, and let me explain a little bit more. I think 10-man rides are getting pretty easily busted because they're not putting pressure on the deep holes, and deep holes are scoring. A, goalie goals are purely electric, but I need something to hate. I need something to criticize. It can't just be like a, wow, what a play. It has to be a little bit more than that. And how bad of a call the Air Force announcers home jobbed that Jacksonville goalie is not even close to my favorite like play of the year that was really cool and interesting, but also gave me a little juice. Because goalie goals, you got to go nuts for them. Like you see it happen in the NLL and college and high school. Like a goalie that goes down and registers a goal, everybody, the sideline, everybody goes nuts. The announcers go nuts. And I was about to fall asleep with their call. And to have that level of bias towards your team, I respect it. I hate it. It was a great goal. It was right as Jacksonville was peaking. You know, Galloway was shitting his pants and going nuts in the locker room and on the field because of it. And I love goalie goals, especially when, especially when it's a reason for me to, it's almost like hitting a hole in one. You're like, oh, I hit a hole in one. And then the rest of the team makes the goalie buy, a bunch of round of Dr. Peppers after the game. So I loved it for on field, off field, the call, everything about it I thought was fantastic.
So the play that you were teasing was on Saturday against Duke in the Carrier Dome. Tucker Dordevic took pass from Landon Clary, who a long stick coming down the middle of the field. And while I believe Syracuse was up 11-9 at this point, maybe it was 12-10, somewhere in that neighborhood, Dordevic put a shot through his legs with his back to the goal. It was Tedesco-esque is the shout out that I would give. And the wrinkle is that he did it one-handed. I don't want to say that it's the goal or play of the year for me just yet, but I do want to get your thoughts on that play before I pick my play of the year.
It's one thing to do it in summer league. It's a whole nother. It was what, like a two goal game at that point?
Yeah, it was absolutely an important goal.
Yeah. That's what, again, that's what separates it. And I think like one of my favorite hockey goals of all time is that Ovechkin goal where he's sliding on his back, but everybody's so quick to criticize it and say, well, the Caps were up 5-1 or whatever the score was. For him to do that in a crucial moment of the game to give them the juice he needs. Or the juice that they need. That's like a season changing from a swagger standpoint play. And I know that because Matt Cavanaugh did that in a loss to Denver. He hit an around the world that shut up a very good crowd. And that memory is so. Have you seen that whole social media thing going around where it's like core memory made?
No, I'm going to need you to explain that to me.
It's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's something that's so impactful that you classify it as a core memory in real time. The most recent example being a viral TikTok where all of St. Peter's student body was watching their win over Purdue, knowing that it's probably going to be an injection of, capital that will impact every student, regard every one of these students know that they're watching something special. Lacrosse, you have to move the goalpost because nothing in sports, I don't think, can touch March Madness. But Matt Cavanaugh scored an around the world in front of a ridiculous Denver crowd that shut them up and even had the crowd kind of going like, damn, bro, that was sick as he walked by. And that was a core memory of that season that propelled us. We went on a run right after that Denver game because every time we were going down, we were like, oh my God, we have Matt Cavanaugh who can do ridiculous stuff like that. So I think that Dordevic play is phenomenal for a couple reasons. Yes, the skill involved, but for a stagnant Cuse team, I think that could be a core memory goal that impacts their confidence as an entire offensive unit going forward, knowing that yes, he's good, but knowing that he just elevated from I'm a great player to everybody, you better know who I am because I don't give a shit. I'm the most talented guy here, and I'm going to prove it by doing a summer league play in what's historically Syracuse Duke, one of the biggest matchups of any college lacrosse season, and I'm going to do it telling you guys that this is how much this is how skilled I am. End rant.
So, for me, the goal of the year is equally recent and far less important. It is not a core memory. It is just, I don't think we've had, there were a couple of moments comparatively early last year like the Joe Robertson goal against Carolina is one that stands out as being an incredible photo more than anything else. And I think that that was one of a handful in the early part of the 2021 season. And I don't feel like we have a substantial number of those so far this year. I mean, we have, you know, some great BTBs and, you know, backhanded goals and 10-man ride breaks, as you pointed out. But the one for me was St. Joe's against Wagner on Saturday. And it was a fake flip, which don't call it a hidden ball trick, that the shot got deflected, hit the ground, bounced. It was still going fast enough that it bounced, went above the height of the crossbar, but it was still in front of the goal. And then enough speed came off of it that it then dipped back down and went in. All the while, the Wagner goalie thought that the guy who the ball had gotten flipped to still had the ball. It's one thing for a fake flip to work. It is quite another for a ball that should have potentially missed the goal twice. First, by virtue of the fact that it was deflected, and second, by virtue of the fact that even after being deflected, it looked like it was going to go over the goal. So, to wrap all three of those factors into one, I tweeted on Sunday, is this the weirdest goal you've ever seen, or is this the weirdest goal you've ever seen? And, oh, for me, it's the goal of the year.
I loved how big of a kick you got out of it, simply because when's the next time we're going to see a goal like that?
And I think that is why I feel justified and okay with making an otherwise pretty meaningless goal my goal of the season so far.
And you know what was one of my favorite parts about it was the cameraman knowing what was going on and sticking
with it.
I hate when the fake flip, the cameraman gets dusted too. So for him to have enough, and I feel like that's got to be the hardest angle, is like, oh, the shot that you have to track the speed, and he just slowed it down enough, but just got it enough so that you could track the ball, even though it was kind of going all around. So props to that cameraman for making your year.
So the cousin of the question I just asked, but it doesn't have to be limited to a play on the field. Could be an interview, quote, a unrelated controversy. What's your social media moment of the year so far?
Yeah, you want me to be honest?
I don't know if
it's
I want you to
be honest. Lacrosse, it's a college lacrosse podcast, but me killing the New York Riptide was far and away my favorite social media moment of the year. I hadn't been in a good beef in a while. Oh, let's just make it with the professional team who I got to meet me in the mud before killing them, and everybody was taking my side, which is never a good sign, but it always is an entertaining sign. And I had so much damn fun with that. It had been so long since I was in a good beef. You know, it doesn't touch Hartzell's beef, but man, it was close. I think it was refreshing. I think it was entertaining. I think it was creative. It, you know, I even posted a video to Twitter, which I rarely do. They put me in clown makeup, and everyone was like, dude, who do you have beef with? And I'm like, oh, the entire franchise, New York Riptide. So because it's lacrosse, I'm confident in putting that. Because it's me, I'll admit to being selfish. But my goodness, because Watchgate just was, you know, late December and not January, I'll put that as my social media moment of the year so far. What's yours?
So I'm going to follow your Charlotte North cue and venture into the women's lacrosse space. And I'm going to give my social media moments of the year to Jenny Levy, the head coach of the North Carolina's women's team. And was it Taylor Moreno? No, it was Andy Aldave, an attacker for North Carolina, who got involved in Instagram comments, essentially either criticizing the refs or criticizing fans' reaction to specific calls. And I'm here for it. There's not enough in post-game press conferences in terms of potential confrontations between essentially coaches, officials, opposing coaches, right? It's just like the sport is still developing to the extent that there's enough drama in those post-game situations in order to really spice it up. But if we can have it happen in a public forum, like the Instagram comments, I know Jenny Levy had an issue with a Charlotte North play that she thought was a charge that wasn't called a charge. And then Andy Aldave made a play against Boston College that the Instagram commenters believed was a crease violation, to which she had to say, well, the ref was standing right there and the ref didn't rule it a crease violation. So I'm glad that the Instagram police decided that they were in a better position. Now, granted, it very much looked like a crease violation. All that being said, I'm very here for players and coaches who were actually involved in not just high profile, but literally the most high profile games of the year, hashing it out in social media comments.
It's one of what I hope, whether it happens more often this year, which, you know, I think that's a perfect example of, or even more next year. I hope that the NIL, I almost said NLI, which would have been a silly mistake, but the NIL deals gives a little bit more slack, because I remember getting in trouble on social for like pretty harmless chirps to like my friends. But because now if you become a big time name and player, you can get paid for it. I hope that provides a little bit of slack, because when something like that happens, the universities rush to it and say, you're representing your university in this way and you need to act this way. I think the pendulum is swinging to where guys like Mark Cuban, Elon Musk are cussing and shitposting memes and making fools of themselves while being extremely successful. I think there needs to be more of that extremely successful. You are a prominent player on a damn good women's lacrosse team. Muck it up in the comments to show your passion for the game. You're
and
actually
that you're a human
being
who actually has feelings and opinions.
Yeah, you're not a robot. You're not just, oh, credit to them. I remember that was one of the first things in PLL training, was like, forget all of your college SID training and don't credit the other team for putting together a good game plan. Do talk smack if you have genuine beef with the guy. And I was like, all right, I can do that. And I hope that that trickles down into college. And again, I really like that being the moment of the year, and I hope that we're competing with several of those situations next year for moment of the year.
All right, Nick. Well, we are going to talk about a few games from this weekend, but we're going to continue this season-to-date long conversation by adding our good friend, Patrick McKeon.
No. First off, Patrick, my mortal enemy, somebody who knows math and statistics versus me, who goes strictly by vibes.
But don't underestimate the power of going by vibes.
You are the king of underestimating vibes, given by your duct taping a phone book to your elbow will make you a better player. No, that would make you look like a nerd, and it won't work. It won't work.
Do we want to get into that?
What happens when a stoppable force meets a movable object?
Like, Nick, all I got to say is, man, if that 3-ounce piece of foam on your elbow can stop you, the defense is going to have no trouble.
Yeah, well, where did you play and how high of a level did you play at?
Let me tell you, Nick, I won the last competitive lacrosse game I ever played in, a little thing called a state championship game.
Oh, nice.
My ankle.
Sick burn.
If we're actually going by performance in our last game, you kicked my ass, because I am still gimping around with a bum ankle. So I'm going to avoid that like the plague.
Yeah, I mean, we may have been up by double digits and I got pulled, so we can put in JV players.
Oh, love it.
What state was this?
It was the Ohio Club Division Championship in 2007.
Oh, I saw that. It was on that was the 30 for 30 I was watching the other day.
Correct.
Hey, man, it was on local cable.
As much as the audience wants to hear.
I can't. And it was going to be about what channel it was on.
I have the videotape. We went Wayne's World style, like local cable access.
Do you ever watch Coach 30, where he's like that guy who breaks down football plays? He's like, I'm terrified of the moment, and I'm just going to piss down my leg.
I'm not familiar.
He's just a guy that roasts film. I might make a series just roasting people's film, and maybe that's game number one.
Is if I get you my high school championship game team?
Just going back to the high school football or high school state championship game. So,
I mean,
either way, I've completely derailed this. Terry, you want to get us back on track?
The shades of the kid I guarded had a very U style game where he just went all right hand from the midfield.
What did the crown of his helmet look like?
It was discolored.
Pretty scuffed up after I got done with him.
There you go. All right. I will get this back on track.
Nick, did you happen to see my Twitter thread about like Notre Dame and the RPI?
I saw a bunch of stuff about it, but I was in the Dallas airport.
For this discussion, I think Notre Dame is some of the most interesting observation I have, I think, is that like Notre Dame's only played half their season. And so if you tell me Notre Dame is the fifth best team in the country and is going to be multiple, like should win every game by multiple goals and probably will, that's a totally different like scenario than they're like, it's too soon to start getting deep into the RPI on Notre Dame because like, it just like, they still have 6 of their 12 games left to go. If they win all those games, that's a very different situation than if they go, you know, 4-2.
Yeah. I mean, it could be said about any relevant statistic or metric. When does it become relevant? Like, what would you argue?
Kind of. I mean, Duke's played 12 games, though.
Which I called out as the dumbest thing of all time. But yeah, I remember Duke being 7-2 and Notre Dame, I think, being 1-2. And there was like huge conversations about the playoff impact that's going to have because Duke and Notre Dame were like very close to each other. And I thought that was the dumbest thing ever. And it's the reason why I don't even really like the NFL Combine anymore, because everyone just goes off of eye tests in the first 3 games of the season and then stick with those storylines pretty much for the duration. And I'm certainly guilty of that with the eye. How much of you is eye test versus RPI? And like, if you had to power rank your top 3 metrics as far as what determines playoff seedings and rankings, what would you say?
What actually does it or what should do it?
What actually does it for you in your mind?
I mean, it's the RPI, like in the metrics. Like the committee, you can, it's not that, like, there's a reason that you can do bracketology and pretty much the committee does some tricky things sometimes that you maybe don't anticipate because of travel or how they handle certain things. But I don't know that the committee ever is really truly a surprise.
So I think that's actually one of the most interesting parts of the question, because it's a way to talk about, well, first of all, I think we skipped a little bit of the first part of the conversation, which is, so the RPI rating percentage index, it is what the NCAA committee uses to organize the data by which they determine the quality of teams' resume, both for at-large selection and for seeding. So baseline, very kind of rudimentary explanation. It's made up of 3 numbers. The first is your winning percentage. The second is your opponent's winning percentage. And the third is your opponent's winning percentage. There's a lot of redundancy that gets built in there, particularly when it comes to league play, because obviously if half of your opponents all play half of their games against your opponents, then there's a duplicating effect within that. And so typically league RPI is a leading indicator for the quality of team resumes. And one of the things that's really important about this is that it becomes more and more relevant as more games are played, meaning that like the amount of variance that happens from one set of games and in the sport of lacrosse is typically like week to week, right? So Saturday to Saturday starts to diminish as the season goes along. Now, you can still see some pretty substantial swings on, you know, conference championship weekend, depending on how things unfold. But Patrick, so one of the conversations around the flaws of RPI is kind of around the same question as to how it's actually used by the committee and why it's worth talking about right now. Not just this year, although it is very worth talking about this year because it's an anomaly relative to prior years, but also any year, because we're kind of bridging that early season into like mid-season, late season, league season part of the schedule. So can you describe what it looks like right now, how it's different from prior years, and what it means for how folks should anticipate this NCAA bracket selection run-up looking like compared to prior years?
So the biggest thing is the Ivy League's collective non-conference record is a clear step above the Big Ten and the ACC. And so that means two things. Is one, the Ivy League teams are all bunched at the top. Right now, they have five of the top eight RPIs. So they all have a chance to get multiple chances to get a top 10 RPI win. And secondly, because they're all playing each other, those, like, as you mentioned, kind of the non-conference records are kind of already baked in for the most part. The ACC has a couple games left, like Notre Dame against Marquette. I think Virginia plays, has another non-conference game or
Syracuse
two left.
Cornell is a big one.
Yeah, Syracuse Cornell. But like the Big Ten is done playing non-conference games. So the kind of collective, the chance of the Big Ten to improve themselves as a whole relative to other conferences is done. And there's very few opportunities remaining for the other conferences. And so, so because that's already been kind of baked in, typically you have seen ACC teams as they keep playing each other, it's kind of been frustrating for fans of other teams as they seem to like kind of move up relative to the Big Ten or the Ivy League because their non-conference records have in the past been so good. This year that's going to happen to the Ivy League. Because that opponent win percentage is 50% of the RPI and the Ivy League's non-conference record so good. Conferences collectively, your conference's collective record in conference games is by definition 500. When two Ivy League teams play, the Ivy League will get one win and one loss. And so it's going to be real tough for some of the, like for some of those ACC and Big Ten teams to pass some of those Ivy League teams in the RPI.
So that was going to be one of the points that I made later during game breakdowns, but my biggest worry as far as Notre Dame not making the playoffs is if the Ivy League starts beating the crap out of each other. And ironically enough, it's been the funniest complete. And if there's one thing I have, it's hypocrisy, and I have it in spades. Because every year I go on this whole tirade about how the SEC football playing close games against each other is the dumbest thing in college football. It screws over, you know, the SEC being a two-bid league. And funny enough, the ACC has kind of been able to tap dance their way into that exact narrative from the lacrosse perspective for the last however long the ACC has been in lacrosse. And I think the fact that this up until this point, the season has played out in a way that is far, you know, it's advantageous for the Ivy Leagues. Looking at Yale Princeton being a two-goal game, Cornell Penn being a four-goal game, looking at, you know, even Dartmouth Harvard, you know, years ago would have been 500-0 Harvard beating Dartmouth, but now it's, you know, a nine-goal game, which isn't exactly close. I just don't think that there's a way that you can justify if the Ivy Leagues continue to play close games that anybody should be jumping over that. So I need one of the Ivy League teams that's not Dartmouth to start getting blown out, because I think what the RPI misses is the margin of victory. And to my knowledge, that's not taken into account at any point.
Correct. The margin of victory and home field advantage are nowhere to be seen in the RPI.
I don't think home field advantage plays as big of a factor as it, you know, necessarily says on paper. I do think that margin of victory is what, you know, call it a Hail Mary for, you know, teams that need a good talking point. But if the Ivies play each other close, I'm now on full on panic mode.
For sure. I mean, home field advantage is what the point of home field advantage is not. It's something widely established in sports that there is an advantage to playing at home. And so it's reasonable to include it in like a computer ranking system. Because it's just so well established as a factor that matters.
So one of the things that I think is really important about this conversation is that, like, it's generally thought that the RPI is not, I don't want to say not a useful tool, but it's not the optimal tool for this exercise. Why is that? And what type of metric would be better?
So, I mean, the RPI is, as far as I understand it, just something some guys came up with in the 70s as like, we want to have an objective computer ranking of teams to use as a criteria for NCAA tournament selection. And this is what they came up with. And there was no back testing of it, no looking at how predictive it was. And so it's one of those, it was good enough to be helpful over nothing, you know, when it was created, but we just have so many more better tools that we can use today. Like, for example, like ones that include factor and home field advantage. The tricky part though of developing better metrics though is that you don't want something that forces coaches to play differently than they would if they're trying to win the games. And so that's where like margin of victory comes into play. It's a little bit tricky to include. That if that becomes the metric that matters, it becomes less useful as a metric for comparing teams if they're playing to the metric. And it's just one of those of if you're in a close game in a one or two goal game at the end, you want, or coaches and players should be playing to maximize their odds of winning the game, not trying to maximize their scoring margin.
Right. Not trying to play to win by three and increase the possibility, yes, or risk that you lose.
Exactly. So I don't know. That's not like not a precise, a great answer to your question. But I like in general, I would say my opinion, like the criteria that you want to use is your ranking better than another one, is how predictive is it? And like that's what like the RPI wasn't developed. Like the weightings are 25%, 50%, 25%, just because that sounded best to somebody. One easy improvement you could make to the RPI is to empirically weight those percentages of win percentage, opponents win percentage, and opponents win percentage to determine which ones are the most predictive at predicting the winner of end of season games.
And I would say that goal differential needs to be put like almost in a way where it was like baked into it. And again, Patrick, you're probably going to shred me for how I describe this, but like win percentage, if you're blowing teams out and you know it, I feel like there's a way to weight goal differential in that opponent win percentage. So you know if it's a team, won't even name any names here because I'm not trying to make any enemies, but ones that gets their
blow. Well, hold on. I mean, we're recording this as Maryland Penn State is unfolding, and we started literally as the game started, and the Terps are up 11-3 with a minute to go in the second quarter. This game is going to end as a non-competitive romp that Maryland should be rewarded for from the standpoint of there was no risk that they were going to lose this game, but they also shouldn't be incentivized to win 25-3 as opposed to 18-3, because what's the
value in
that?
Why not? You missed your participation trophy?
So I think I can split the difference for you guys. So my favorite metric, actually, if you're going to do something like this, first of all, I should say, like, given the stat keeping of lacrosse, one of the few stats that I trust to be recorded correctly is goals and the time at which a goal is scored. That if you're going to trust any stat keeping, like, that is a stat you can trust. In the play-by-play is I would say it's empirical win probability is look at what are the odds that a team that's up by 8 goals in the second quarter wins that game. It's like 99%. And so you can have a metric based on empirical win probabilities that differentiates between an 8 goal lead in the second quarter versus, you know, a 3 goal lead in the second quarter that expands to 8 in the fourth quarter. And maybe, you know, you put on maybe that 8th goal is an empty netter just for fun, that it allows you to the difference between scoring a goal in the last minute versus not scoring a goal and affects your cumulative empirical win probability throughout the game so little as to not matter.
What if there was a way where it's like, if you're keeping track of scores and times, if, like, say in the second quarter, you have a 10 goal lead, for every second you have that 10 goal lead, it is, more valuable
That's
than.
exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're on the same page with that.
The way that you do it, yeah. The way I'm talking about it is so is like
Damn, I hate being
cumulative
on the same
empirical
page.
win probability is that metric. You look at of like the last 5 years when teams are up by X number of goals with Y seconds left, how often do they win? And you accumulate, yeah, your like win value for each game. The more goals you are up by the earlier in the game, the more sort of the more cumulative win probability you accumulate, and the better that's going to reflect upon you in a metric.
We're agreeing on this. I hate this. And also, it should be taken into account how gold the helmets are. Just to derail this a little bit.
So, Patrick, to bring this in for
Patrick.
a landing, what should fans be ready for when it comes to how many ACC teams, how many Big Ten teams, and how many Ivy League teams are going to get into the NCAA tournament?
So I think the big thing that you have to think about is how structured are the conferences going to be. I think sort of Nick got at it with like the question, like Yale beating Princeton was fantastic for the Ivy League's probability of getting a bunch of teams into the tournament. The best thing that can happen for the Ivy League is if the top five teams, if Princeton, Penn, Harvard, Yale, and Cornell, if they all beat Brown and Dartmouth in every game. If Dartmouth can, like, what's going to derail the Ivy League is if Dartmouth can pick up an upset over somebody. And I think the same thing with the ACC and the Big Ten. The probability the Big Ten gets three teams into the tournament go a lot better if Maryland, Rutgers, and Ohio State can each hold serve and beat Penn State, Johns Hopkins, and Michigan in each of those matchups. The odds of the Big Ten getting three teams is a lot better. With the ACC, I think it's a little bit tricky because you kind of have Notre Dame and Duke are 15th and 16th in the RPI. And I guess Duke just lost this year, which doesn't help that. But it's kind of one of those that remains to be seen. But the more clearly you have a top two or three teams in your conference, the easier it is for those teams to get in. And so I think that's kind of what you should be looking at in those conferences.
So Virginia's good. And then beyond that, in the ACC, we don't know.
Well,
Carolina, Duke,
North Carolina is
Syracuse,
ninth
and
in the RPI,
yeah.
so they're looking pretty good. But I mean, it's one of those of if they lose, if they go, the ACC is like it's possible UNC could go what oh and how many conference games do they have left? Like four. If they go
Yeah.
0-4 in those conference games, that's gonna be real bad for their chances of getting in. Where, if they win out, they're all but a lock.
We're going to transfer into talking about the weekend's games, but before we do, I just don't want to let the opportunity go by without talking about this project that Patrick and I have been spending a lot of time on basically over the course of the last 90 days. We essentially created a fantasy lacrosse game contest. I don't know. How would you describe it?
I mean, I think it's both. It's a
Yeah.
contest and a game.
What was the inspiration?
So the inspiration was the social media game where you make it's typically a 5x5 grid, and they'll say you have $15, assemble your ideal in basketball, like assemble your all-time starting five, and they'll give you Michael Jordan and Wilt and Kareem and all those guys as options in that 5x5 grid. And we made the actual version of that in lacrosse.
And one thing I wanted to emulate was I think that lacrosse being a game where teams largely play once a week and tend to play Saturday at noon or Saturday at 1, there's this moment between 2 and 3:30 on Saturday afternoons that is pretty equivalent to the witching hour in the NFL, as dubbed by the Red Zone channel, where so much activity happens. There's this frenetic nature to in the NFL fantasy football. You win and lose your game so frequently between 3:45 and 4:15 on a Sunday afternoon. And I was like, we can emulate that. So we're going to create a contest where you pick six players, but I don't think that it's going to be very fun if a goal is worth 1 point, an assist is worth 1 point, a ground ball is worth 1 point, cost turn. You know what I mean? It was like we had to get every quantifiable stat and then adjust it in order to create a game that was a little bit more like fantasy football in terms of the variability and volume of scoring. So, Patrick, you did a lot of reverse testing in order to decide on the right amounts that each stat was worth. How did you come to the conclusions that you did? What did you decide upon?
So right now we have the scoring is a goals and assists are worth 3 points. Turnovers are -1. Cause turnovers worth 6 points. Ground balls are worth 2 and a save is worth 1. And the idea behind that is that the top scorers at every position are scoring in relatively equal amounts. So actually, if you look at scoring right now, you have Roy Meyer from BU as a defender. Zach Cole from St. Joseph's, a faceoff guy. Will Mark from LIU is a goalie. And Matt Brandel from Yale is an attackman, are four of the top five scorers, average per game scorers in fantasy. And that's that.
The fact that they're distributed across four different positions is awesome.
Yes, right? That's exactly.
It suggests that, you know, you kind of accomplished the goal.
Yes, exactly. That's the idea, is that in the game, the obvious strategy shouldn't be to spend all your money on offensive players or on goalies or on faceoff guys. That picking a $5 attackman and a $3 defender and a, you know, $2 goalie should inherently be just as viable as a strategy as picking a $2 attackman and a $5 goalie. If you pick the right matchups and players for that week.
So we've done this open to the public. And when you said spend your money, we're talking about a figurative budget of $18 to spend across six players. We've had a couple thousand entries, had a couple hundred players involved. We've done 22 contests, I think, that are open to the public. What's your reaction on how it's unfolded?
I think it's been fun. I have really enjoyed both playing and watching and seeing what lineup and what different strategies people are employing to win games.
What do you think's next?
In terms of what?
How do we take this thing to the next level?
That's a good question. I actually would feel like I want to hear from Nick about what does Nick think we should do to take it to the next level.
This is not, I mean,
Nick, there's one obvious answer. I know you took a gambling compliance class, but there's one answer.
I mean, it has to be for money.
Correct.
But I will say, because we kicked around the idea of trying to do something similar before, we were like, okay, we can't even do anything at all ever. I think there could be some interesting giveaway opportunities, and I think that there are some really interesting ways that you can get creative about that. And it's almost like there are people in lacrosse, both pros. Obviously we can't loop college players into it, but if there was a way that you could put together a package that you pitched correctly, where it was like, all right, everybody get on board because, you know, fantasy lacrosse is here and we can do it and it's fun. And not only do you win this tangible prize, but you also get, like, if you're first place this week, then you do, like, you get a FaceTime or some PLL player joins your high school Zoom session film breakdown to go over man down defense. And I'll tell you one thing, Terry and Patrick, what gets the people going even more than prizes is punishments. So if you put out a challenge like play with your buddies, and whoever comes in last place, whoever has the most creative last place prize or punishment, wins this package that also the best scorer does, then you have people facilitating groups because it's always fun to dogpile onto your friends. You know, it's like that Waffle House thing went viral. So there needs to be punishment and rewards with incentives on each. And that's how I'm doing anything, is like, can I make my friends suffer or can I win money off of it, is really what it comes down to.
We're still early days on this, but very excited about how it's gotten going. So before we move on, just wanted to thank Patrick for his effort on this. It's been really fun to watch develop.
So, guys, would love to do this. Let's recap some of the games of the weekend. Yale 14, Princeton 12. Matt Brando scores 5 and 3 assists. Jared Paquette makes 19 saves. Alex, and because I'm in Mexico, Vardardo as 4-2 for the Tigers. Gentlemen, I want to get your thoughts on this all-time nerd matchup. And we'll start with you, Terry.
Yeah, I watched this game pretty closely. And it's hard not to say it's the game of the weekend because Yale came in 3-2 and they upset the number two team in the country. But at the same time, not to brag, I picked the Tiger. I'm sorry, I picked the Bulldogs. Wow, really kind of flubbed that one. But it was a wild game to watch from the standpoint of I wasn't confident in my pick until Carson Kuhl scored the 14th goal of the game to put Yale up with like a, what was it, 220 to go. And throughout the third and fourth quarter, they weren't able to separate. It was a weird game from the standpoint of felt like Princeton shot themselves in the foot a fair amount. Felt like scoring was more difficult for Yale than you would expect from a team that put up 14. And ultimately, they had this, I would describe as season-defining sequence from the six-minute mark of the fourth quarter to the 2:30 mark of the fourth quarter when, as I mentioned, Kuhl scored to give them their insurance goal to put them up two, where they got three different resets. They called a timeout during that sequence. So they ran literally four different midfield lines during a 3.5-minute sustained possession. The signature play of the moment was Brian Tevlin checking George Bond after he had gotten a save rebound on the end line. And then Tevlin took it away from him and facilitated two possessions later or two sequences later, Yale scoring the game winner. But, you know, I don't want to oversimplify a game that had 26 goals. And, you know, after that, there was, I think, five possessions in the last 2.5 minutes. There were two saves. It was, you know, crazy and frenetic from that point on. But that 3.5-minute sequence was absolutely the situation in which the game was decided. And the only reason that Yale was in a position to do that was because Jarrett Paquette made 19 saves. I mean, we've seen some incredible performances from Ivy League goalies so far this year. I mean, non-conference and conference games. Obviously, Eric Peters has been tremendous. I think he was great against Rutgers. Kyle Mullen was fantastic against Brown. So, you know, that's not coming as a surprise. But at the same time, just a really impressive showing from Yale in a really important game because they lose that one. They, you know, fall to 3-3. They go to 0-2 in the Ivy League. It's not a position they haven't found themselves in before, but it's certainly going to cause them maybe to second guess or question some of the things that they've done in order to get to that position.
And Patrick, what are your thoughts on Terry's commentary?
One thing I do not like about a lot of the top 20 ratings discourse is how some people just completely ignore what certain teams do like over the first four games and rank them anyways. And I feel like Yale has escaped a lot of criticism for that Penn State loss. And many people, like Terry, believed that Yale was good and that the Penn State loss was a fluke. And I feel like this game for sure validated that opinion as emphatically the correct one.
So just to defend my point of view in two very different ways. The first is Penn State, despite their getting blottoed as we record right now, proved to be better than their loss to St. Joe's suggested that they were in their one-goal losses to Cornell and Penn. And when you really dive deep, and no voter is in a position to do this on more than a handful of games a weekend, but when you really dive deep on that 10-6 Penn State win over Yale, you see an Alaric Fayek performance that was very anomalous. And again, how much allowance should you make for that? Well, you're right. It definitely starts from the standpoint of what is your preconceived notion and how much are you going to utilize that type of evidence in order to affirm or disprove it? And I will concede that I thought Yale was going to be good based on what I saw in the fall and was going to be slow to move off of that position. So I was going to use what I felt like was a anomalous explanation as an anomalous explanation. I'm not going to take a victory lap for the fact that Yale beat Princeton as validating. I think that there's a reality where Princeton is a little bit closer to the eighth best team in the country than the second best team in the country. In addition to which, I didn't feel comfortable that Yale was going to win that game at any point throughout it. So, you know, there are still a lot of questions for the Bulldogs. They've got a Quaker team coming to town on Saturday, and I don't know who I'm going to pick in that one.
How do you get the media? How do you get the right to vote in the media poll? Because I want to start getting in there, and I feel like it's just kind of willy-nilly right now. What's the deal with that?
I decide whether or not you get the right to vote in the media poll.
Oh, so you're who I have to bribe, huh?
Pretty much. Got to show up on time for the podcast.
Oh, no deal then. I'm good.
On to the next game.
Penn 15, Cornell 11. Another battle of the nerds. Sam Hanley posted 3 goals and 3 assists, making a full transition back to midfield. Interestingly enough, Patrick Birkinshaw making 15 saves total. Penn with a 4-goal victory over Cornell. Patrick, what does this mean to you?
I think it means that Sam Hanley has to run out of the box, doesn't it?
Don't ask me. I'm just here to facilitate the questions. I'm an unbiased journalist reporter, and you can ask Terry that question, but I refuse to answer.
Which is one of those things of, so I'm a big advocate of the reason that you play midfield is because you're not good enough to play attack.
Bold. I like it.
And that, like, it's something high school coaches have figured out for years, is like your best player has to play attack, because it would be silly to not have your best player on the field for the entire game on offense. And for whatever reason, it didn't work out for Sam Hanley at attack and running him out of the box. I guess he's just more comfortable, or it gets him better matchups, or something. I don't have a great answer for you at this point, but I think that this game validates or says that that's the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, my point of view on that was, coming into the game, I felt like Gavin Adler was probably the best defender in the country, and I think I still think that. But it was so fascinating to me how intent Cornell was on making sure that he was guarding Hanley at the top of the box, even though the majority of the time that he's spent so far this year has been below GLE or right at, you know, dodging wings, or, you know, defending wing dodges. And I mean, Patrick, like, I'm going to push back on your point about midfielders and attackmen in two ways. The first is, you know, wouldn't you want a midfielder to be able to play defense, right? Like, that's kind of the nature of the position. And then secondly is kind of where I think we really dive in with Hanley, which is angles of attack and, to your point, matchups. And I think that's the part that, Nick, you could probably shed some light on from the standpoint of, I would assume you were a midfielder because your coaches wanted to take advantage of your athletic versatility. But what's the difference in an offensive set between being a midfielder and being an attackman?
So, yes, we can. I could talk about being a versatile athlete. I think it came down to me not having nearly the good enough stick skills. And it comes down to a lot of coaches' preference. Like, if we look at those Notre Dame offenses, the midfielders knew their roles and were, you know, I distinctly remember a time sophomore year when I took a bad shot, because that shot means that I wasn't able to get back in on defense. And it was the reason why Notre Dame was a defensive heavy program, because we had the athletic midfielders that could do so. But when I got to the pros and realized that the versatility of the midfield position can lean offensively, and that can also provide really interesting dynamics to any team game, it becomes a lot of, oh, well, now we're just looking at individual matchups and there's nuance to the team A versus team B. But I always thought, and I err more on the side of, a midfielder is there because he's the best offensive player who won't get embarrassed on defense. And I think that an offensive player has, or a midfielder has to have a rudimentary understanding of defense, and the attackman can know the offense almost in the way that quarterbacks know every position on the field. There were times at Notre Dame in which the midfielders spend half their time at the defensive end and half their time at the offensive end, which means that the attackman, who's working with every midfielder group, gets to be comfortable with them and also gets to quarterback them where if we're running a play that I might not have the best understanding, whether it's coming out of a timeout or calling out plays or nuances, or Ocello cut third pass. Okay, well, the defense knows that, but they don't know where I'm going to cut and that that cut's going to a pick. So I say have your best offensive players on attack and have your best athletes who understand defense in the midfield. And if you had to put a preference on one, I would say having a more robust midfield line gives a little bit more of an advantage, only because I'm a product of Jerry Burns' college teachings.
I don't disagree, but but I still say, like, the answer is always if you were better, if you had Lyle Thompson's offensive skill set, they would have put you at attack.
Yes, correct. But also, yeah, way to cherry pick the most generational talented lacrosse player.
A player who was a midfielder coming out of college or coming out of high school who got switched to attack, which I think is part of his point.
Yeah, that's exactly my point. Is the answer is always if you were better at offense, then you would play attack.
Yes. Personally speaking, I also faced off Humble Brag, so we would have had to figure out how that worked. All right, anyways, Syracuse 14, Duke 10. Heavyweight historic matchup. Tucker Dordovic has 5 goals, 2 assists, and the obvious highlight between the legs. Take a suck on it, Duke. Bunch of losers. And the QSD bottled up Duke down the stretch, which I particularly found interesting. Patrick, you had the floor last time. Terry, we'll give you the floor. First 30 seconds and initial reactions to Syracuse triumphing over Duke. You got it.
Yeah, so as the designated Syracuse hater, a season-saving win, and candidly not one that I'm surprised by, and it has nothing to do with Duke. I'm going to leave that room for Patrick to explore because I know he's got a lot to say. But for Syracuse, it was always going to be a work in progress. And I thought our friend Dan Arestia made a good point when he talked about the development that we've seen out of, you know, guys like Matteo Corsi and Mikey Berkman, who have gotten better as the season's gone along. It is too easy to scheme and game plan for a 2-man offense. And despite the fact that they have death injuries to Lucas Quinn and then won in this game, Syracuse has more options. And Tucker Dordovic put up 8 points. So it's not that they're relying less on him. It's that he's getting more space because they have more dangerous guys complementing him. And not only that, but they've also done a really nice job of not relying exclusively on creating offense in 6-on-6 sets. And I think Sam Alexo, you know, I was talking earlier about most underrated players. I think Jacob Angeles from Hopkins is like in the top 25 most underrated players in college lacrosse right now. I think Sam Alexo is as well. Patrick, Duke, your floor.
I actually think – so can I first say, it's like I feel like the story of this game wasn't like – the Syracuse offense scoring 14 goals is great for them. But I feel like the last three – like – The turnaround in the Syracuse defense is really the story of the Syracuse season, isn't it?
Well, I think that in order for that to be true, you need to address your issues with Duke's effort level.
You went from giving up 16 to Hobart, 17 to Army, 20 to Virginia, to giving up 10, 9, 10 the last three games. When we can talk about possessions and efficiency, but like it's been much more efficient. Syracuse has skyrocketed up the adjusted efficiency ratings on defense. I'll give you my Duke take on effort. It's just when I go watch the Duke film, like it's just so clear to me that the effort level isn't there.
Until
their back's against the wall and it's correct. Like, oh man, so we actually have to try. And you've seen it in every game. That they get down to Loyola to Jacksonville in this one is there gets a point and it's like, oh man, like their backs are against the wall and they hustle. And then it's like, they score 6 goals in 5 minutes. And it just, you get this inevitability in the comebacks in those games against Jacksonville at Loyola of like, this is a runaway train that the other team can't stop. They just have to hopefully slow it down long enough to hold on. And it wasn't quite that way against Syracuse, but Bucks, I think Syracuse probably has more talent than those teams. And we're able to hang on and really, you know, we're able to hang on to the, to survive a Duke flurry of goals, and then to get it close and come back and extend their lead, which other teams haven't been able to do. But I guess I my opinion has not really changed. I think that Duke is one of the, I mean, say three, is it too generous to them to say they're one of the three most talented teams in the country? And it's, in my mind, the difference between is almost entirely about effort level.
It seems really ungenerous to the four or five Ivy League teams that we think are going to make the NCAA tournament to say that you guys have had better seasons than Duke so far and you're not as talented. But to the point of them potentially being third, I mean, yeah, clearly Maryland and Virginia are the two most talented teams, and then Duke is in that mix. So continuing on, because I think that it's helpful to talk about these games in context as well.
Yes.
Or in conjunction. Go ahead.
To this, I guess. So
last 10 seconds.
I'm actually a firm believer. I say I'm using talent in a way that I actually don't really mean it. I'm a firm believer that hustle and effort is a talent. And so in that sense, when I say Duke is one of the three most talented teams, I mean outside of hustle and effort, that bringing it on a day-to-day basis is part of, like, is an ability. Not everyone can do it. And I think that's when we need to, like, maybe Duke just can't, it doesn't have the ability to bring it, to bring a required effort level all the time.
Got it. Virginia. Okay. Let's fly through this one. Damn it. Virginia 12, Notre Dame 8. Matt Nunez made 12 saves. It was like, oh, I didn't know he realized he made that many saves, said some Virginia coach, not even going to name names. Schellenberger, 3 goals, 2 assists. What do you guys think? Patrick, you have the floor.
I very, very vividly remember watching Matt Nunez in high school. And my ability to evaluate high school goalies at the next level, it in terms of stopping ability, is not there. Is leaves a lot to be desired. But I remember watching that kid and thinking, wow, he's every single other thing you could ever want out of a goalie, he is the best goalie prospect I've ever seen. And so the fact that
sick
he,
brag.
Huh?
Sick brag about being right. I mean, anyways, go ahead. I was just giving you a hard time.
So the fact that he is able to stop the ball at that level means I think he has the potential to be an all-time goalie. And that is, I think, a scary thing for the rest of the ACC.
Yeah, having an all-time goalie would be a scary thing. Very good point. Terry, what do you got?
Notre Dame didn't play very well. My point 2 weeks ago about how they need to improve 10%, maybe 20% in all three facets, looked more like 30 to 40%, at least at the offensive and defensive ends of the field against Virginia. It really didn't feel like they were going to be able to score. And had, for as much of it had to do with Nunes, I think it equally had to do with every other aspect of the Virginia defense. So kind of felt like they were on cruise control offensively. And honestly, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more fire coming out of having gotten humbled the way that they did against Maryland. So I don't know. Little concerned about the Cavaliers. They're going to be number two on Monday, but I don't think they wake up feeling a ton better relative to the way that they felt against Maryland. But, you know, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe they dominated Notre Dame at home and that was what they needed.
Yeah, well, because that's my thing, I'll just chime in. Yes, I'm starting to worry about the pissed offness level. Like, not that I condone it, even though I make a bunch of jokes about it, but like, very few times did we have bad stretches in my 4 years there. Sick brag. But when we dropped two or three in a row, I don't even know how many times that happened. Like, that fourth game, we were coming out like heads on fire, even like couple penalties in the first quarter just to calm everything down, everybody relax. And I'm not seeing
to get
that.
It out.
Yeah, get it out. All right, hey, let's set the tone. Let's put someone on the floor. Let's get hyped up for a 2-minute non-releasable, and then let's take a deep breath and get to work.
I think that's something too about the Ivy League. They didn't play lacrosse for a year, and they've all come out in these first handful of games have played like they really missed playing lacrosse.
Yeah, and we look like we're in May, and we've already played a full season's worth, and we're just like, okay, here we go again.
Also, exactly. They're kind of playing like a team that's accomplished something, and they haven't.
I wonder, too, like, I think, too, this season you probably have almost full rosters of ACC kids who have all come up thinking that every ACC team makes the NCAA tournament every year, and that's just kind of what happens because you go to an ACC school.
Yes and no. It's one of those things where it's like every single time that you assume that, the coach, especially knowing Corrigan as well as I do, it ain't a good locker room. It ain't happy. It ain't nothing like that. And as a coach, you kind of come to that inflection point of, do we need a day of team bonding, or do we need to just put the foot on the gas and make these guys realize that it ain't all sunshine and rainbows, and you are going to not enjoy practice until you get it together. I don't know. I'll actually try and do some digging about that, because I know that even in the alumni text, it's like, all right, especially with Will Corrigan, my teammate, doing well at Harvard, the last thing we wanted to see is a bunch of those nerds doing better than Notre Dame. But I would say that that's inarguable at this point. Moving on, last game that we will talk about, North Carolina 15, Bellarmine 8.
Not a game that we expected to talk about heading into the weekend.
No, not at all. I thought that this was going to be, 15-8 really does not speak to how the game went, because Bellarmine was up after three quarters before UNC's, I think the third quarter or fourth quarter adjustment, was having a cup of coffee and rolling out of bed and, waking up, because they woke up in that fourth quarter, but they were down after three. Patrick.
I think it just illustrates, it's what we've been talking about, that showing up and effort is a talent. It's an ability, and the ACC teams have not shown that ability. And this was another example of it, of Bellarmine showed up to play in the first half and North Carolina did not. And I don't think it's a knock against Bellarmine to say that that was the only way they're going to be up on North Carolina at halftime is if North Carolina didn't play their best.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think that it's worth pointing out that they're playing 10 freshmen and that they are going to be a very uneven team. It's remarkable. I mean, this was a team that, and I tweeted this, their coach, Andy Whitley, had high expectations for heading into this year, and they lost 2 1-goal games in their first three, and then a 2-0 game as well. So, four goals go differently, and instead of being 2-7 heading into this one, they're more like 5-4. And in addition to that, it's compounded by the fact that, they really got beaten badly by High Point and Jacksonville in two games, immediately prior to this. So I give them a lot of credit for their ability to bounce back and just play well.
No, it's yes. Saying that, though, doesn't mean, not every team in the – there are many teams in the country that, even when North Carolina is not playing well, are still not going to be able to play good enough to be up on them at halftime.
Right.
That's not – it's like what I say about when teams, beat bad teams by 20 goals, is that's – if you're a good team, that's what you're supposed to do. When other teams don't come out and play hard, you're supposed to be able to beat them. And when they're not playing their best, you're supposed to be able to get up. And that's what good teams do. And so doing it is still a positive sign, even if you being up at halftime requires the other team to not be playing at their best.
And with that, yeah, let's bring it back home. Let's each give a piece of advice to our loyal listeners. My piece for advice that's really helped out my life: follow more dog accounts on Instagram, TikTok, whatever social media platform you use. Logging on and knowing that you're going to see more dogs, puppies, Bernese Mountain Dogs, pit bulls, Vislas, all that stuff. I think it's a great way to brighten your day and make social media, which is normally a cesspool of political arguing, a little bit brighter. Terry and Patrick, what are your guys' tips of the day as we sign off?
I've got three.
Jesus. All right.
When you wake up, drink two 8-ounce glasses of water immediately.
Oh, I thought you were going to say wine.
That's last week's advice. Floss. After you drink the water, floss your teeth, and then stretch. Get a 5-minute stretch in. If that's how you spend the first 6.5 minutes of your day, you're setting yourself up for success.
All right. So drink 2 8-ounce glasses of Cabernet Agua, floss your teeth, and then stretch. Patrick, what do you got?
Agua Blanc.
Number one, I would say, Nick, the real advice you should give on social media is don't ever go on it. But secondly, if you are going to go on it, don't believe the basketball hype accounts that say that everyone can hustle, because everyone cannot hustle. Hustle is a skill.
All right. So, hey, listen, don't go on social media. If you do, follow more accounts. Don't follow basketball hustle accounts. When you wake up, a tall glass, 2 8-ounce glasses, maybe 1 16-ounce glass of water.
Don't make it too cold. Don't give yourself a brain freeze. Go to like the midpoint between room temperature and as cold as the faucet gets.
All right, just a lightly chilled 2 glasses of water. So either way, gentlemen, thank you for letting me host. Very insightful, very good stuff, and I appreciate you.
Love you, Nick.
Love you, Terry.
Love you, Patrick. Love you, Patrick.
Thanks, guys. I was waiting for it. I love you, too.
Oh, there we go. Let's go. Now it's a good day.
I love all our listeners, too.
Let's relax. Boo. Pandering. 30-second technical pandering.
All American listeners. Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.